Welcome to episode 12 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse, in which four friends and Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 through 3 before season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Well, it's the bottom of the second and the top of the third. For the first time, we're tackling a season finale and the following season premiere, like simultaneously and stuff. Let's go around and introduce ourselves before we launch into the discussion.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Katie Burt.
And I'm Warren Fry.
Welcome back, Warren.
Yay.
And hooray for me.
And you're back in time for like a couple of really, really substantial episodes.
These are some damn good eps.
Before we get into the clever synopses and talking about the episodes in depth, I'm curious what you all thought about watching the season finale of season 2 and the season premiere of season 3 back to back.
We've talked about this before on the podcast. So many of these episodes feel like they could be season enders that this really did feel like it could have been. It didn't feel like two different seasons. It's actually really impressive that it is, I think, and that it's so, you know, tonally moves between the two.
They were gone for months and they just really picked up literally where they left off.
The thing that really makes it stand out as a season premiere is they have that thing at the beginning that's like, oh, we might go to war. What is this proto molecule? It's like a little recap for, like, I don't know, if you forgot since you watched, like, they're trying to, like, catch you up, even though if you think that's going to catch you up, it tells you almost nothing.
True.
Yeah, in both episodes, you know, the show always has good visual effects, as we were talking about before, but both these episodes, probably because they were a season finale and a season premiere, felt like they had some really beautiful sequences that weren't necessary in terms of how epic they were in scope that you might not get in a mid-season episode.
For sure.
I've got to wonder how practical all the stuff where Bobby's running around is, like, and the obvious stuff where there's a giant spaceship and a little figure running up it, but the other stuff, like, just how much of that is totally in camera. It would not surprise me to find out a bunch is.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Yeah. It's such a rich couple of episodes. There's so much going on in there. Let's hit the synopses and then dive in detail. First episode we watched was Caliban's War, the season 2 finale, first aired April 19th, 2017. The standoff between Jean-Pierre Mao's team and Christian, Bobby, and Kotcher escalated quickly, and Kotcher took one for the team. Fortunately, Kotcher packed Bobby's power armor, and she crawls through the ductwork for it, going through Mao's men like they were tissue paper, and striking a deal with a maintenance tech who really doesn't want to die for Mao. She rescues Christian Kotcher and proves that she is Iron Man. Meanwhile, remember the proto-molecule hybrid that was hanging on the outside of the Rossi? Just as Holden's coming to terms with letting go of his protomolecule obsession, the hybrid turns up in the cargo hold. You'd think this is an opportunity for catharsis for Holden, but instead he gets pinned to a bulkhead by a magnetic crate and nearly killed. The crew tries to figure out how to save him and remove the hybrid before it makes for the Rossi's reactor core and has a fatal dinner for everyone. But finally, Prax suggests luring it out with a warhead. Naomi and Prax do the honors, and Alex flips the ship to burn the hybrid down to its component proto-molecules. And that's your season finale triumph. But wait! Complication the first. Remember the Arbogast? The ship that was taking up valuable screen time exploring the proto-molecule crater on Venus? You'll have to remember it, because the proto-molecule wakes up and takes it apart, bolt by bolt. Poor Adam Savage.
Who?
And complication the second. Remember the proto-molecule torpedo Naomi's been hiding all along? She tells a recovering Holden, no more secrets, remember, that when she thought she was going to die on the Weeping Somnambulist, she texted its location to Fred Johnson. And now Earth, Mars, and the Belt have the proto-molecule, and Holden's just a little bit thunderstruck.
And then we have Fight or Flight, which aired almost a year later on April 11th, 2018. With Christian out of the way, Ehrenreich wastes no time in pushing Secretary General Gillis to declare war on Mars. He then uses his carefully constructed information to convince Gillis that Avasarala was running a shadow government. He totally would have mentioned these important state secrets sooner, but he just loves Christian so much. Meanwhile, Christian is dealing with the repercussions of Ehrenreich's treason. She's got her handy future magic medkit to patch up Kotiar's gunshot wound. Bobby snags her meek but helpful low-level employee who she stored in a locker to help regain control of the ship, which works for a hot second before they realize they have 17 minutes before the missiles Aaron Wright sent hit. But not before Christian snags the evidence of Aaron Wright's treason. They race to get to Julie Mao's racing ship, which only has room for two. Bobby and Christian just beat the blast of the missile. Does the dropship with Kotiar and the low-level employee make it? On the Rossi, they're cleaning up the remnants of the proto-molecule man, which is easier than cleaning up the emotional mess of Naomi revealing that she gave Fred Johnson the proto-molecule. Alex just wants to keep the fam together. And, oh hey, maybe send a quick message to that family he left on Mars? Amos calculates they aren't that strong together anymore. And Holden is so pissed he breaks the coffee maker. But hey, he loves a good cause, and remember Prax's daughter? Maybe they could save her? They decide to head to Io, not Tycho, and a little bit of the proto-molecule they missed is hitching along for the ride. Finally, Fred Johnson sends a message to Dawes about the proto-molecule sample. And remember that ship they left floating in space? Why not turn the Naboo into a warship for the Belt?
Yeah, a couple of inconsequential episodes there.
No, not at all. Nothing happens.
Nope.
You just sort of drop there at the end, and I'm sorry. All I can think about is the Mormon Cathedral gunship, you know, imagining that. And
I just thought, once again, the Mormons are getting screwed over.
Yeah, man.
I don't know why I have such Mormon sympathy in this show, but I do. They just get, they never get a good break, and they made the damn thing. They built this huge spaceship. It's not fair. Anyway.
I get you. So let's talk about, let's break down these episodes into their component parts, just like the proto-molecule did, the Arbogast. And let's take a look at the Rossi components. We finally have it out between Holden and the proto-molecule man, who is, I don't know, he's just this cute, lovable Muppet, right?
He really is.
Those eyes, they just make you feel like nothing. He doesn't have anything that he's, you know, no bad intentions.
I guess those creature effects are the toughest thing to do. And these aren't 100%, but it's also a TV show, so I don't hold that against it. It's still pretty terrifying.
It's also interesting, like, I feel like a lot of times you don't get to see a lot of whatever the creature is.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of, like, the proto-molecule, like, hiding or being in shadow. You just see it in this episode, and it's still terrifying to me.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty
totally
impressive.
Yeah, this is a good Halloween watch.
It is. And, you know, we're overdue. The conflict between the proto-molecule and the Marines on Ganymede was, there were flashes of it. You didn't get a whole lot, but this was down and dirty in full view of the cameras.
And it probably cost a lot, which is why it's the finale episode.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I get a Ridley Scott's Alien vibe from sort of the level of the conflict. You know, it's handled in different ways. But after all of this stuff over the last 2 years of Holden versus the idea of the proto-molecule, and now he's up against it, literally, mano a mano. And you'd think that that'd be really cathartic for him, and yet.
It's always great when someone has a vendetta and the person or thing that they have a vendetta against has, like, no idea. And, you know, I'm assuming doesn't know who Holden is, doesn't particularly care who Holden is, has his own goals, namely to get to the nuclear reactor. But
yeah, like, we're not even sure this thing is conscious, to be honest with you. Like, conscious, like, beyond being an animal kind of conscious.
Yeah, I mean, it's clever, and it can do things, and it does dig the failsafe detonator out of its own chest. Mm-hmm. So it's got some level of self-awareness, but it just gives up on Holden once it decides that it's not a threat and there's a snack below the deck plates.
Yeah, I find it interesting these guys are doing all this work to better the human race, in quotes, and yet all they're doing is coming up with glow-in-the-dark monster dudes.
There are a lot of great, like, little problem-solving moments or brainstorming moments amongst the Rossi crew trying to figure out what to do to get rid of the proto-molecule man. And I don't know, it's so great that, like, there actually are a lot of really good ideas, but the thing that complicates it is, how do we solve this problem and not kill any member of our crew, at least one member of our crew? I love problem solving in space, and The Expanse does it better than any other show because they actually do try to stick to some rules of real life science.
Yeah, it's got a bit of the Apollo 13 thing going on.
Mm.
Holden's there just like, you know, forget about me. Just get rid of the thing. But he's not completely needlessly throwing away his life. If they come up with some ideas, you know, Amos has a suggestion that Amos lies and says it might not kill Holden. And Holden's like, okay, yeah, we could try that. Holden's vulnerability in this point, you know, the easy thing for this story would have been a knockdown, drag out fight. If the Rossi had any corridors to speak of, a tunnel hunt with the hybrid. And instead, he spends most of the episode pinned to the wall. Intensely frustrating.
But good TV.
And you get, like, both the practical, like, how do we get rid of this without killing Holden? But you also, it gives him some of these moments to have conversations with Naomi and Amos and kind of come up against his feelings. And because he's kind of been running away from in a lot of ways while he's been on this quest.
I would not have been surprised if they, because I haven't read the books, if they had just killed off Holden at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
I was prepared for that.
Because they even have that line, and there's a lot of, like, magic space medicine in both these episodes, but there's a line early on with Amos where he's like, well, like, with these types of injuries, the, like, potassium in his blood might just kill him. Like, regardless of whether they're getting this protomolecule off the ship, he's, like, very physically injured. I could have seen the show like, oh, we got rid of the protomolecule man and his, you know, heart just stopped or whatever. They have those moments that feel like the moments they give characters before they die.
And again, it is the last episode of the second season, so this would be the time to off him if you're going to do
mm-hmm.
it.
And thematically, I think it actually would have worked well for his character. I mean, it would have been sad.
Yeah. What do y'all think of the conversation between Holden and Naomi? While he's against the wall and all that.
That was some tough going, is what that was.
It's interesting that he calls back to the girlfriend he had in the first episode, like saying that he was in the opposite of that situation before, saying goodbye to someone he cared about.
I had to remember that happened.
I know, because right. I was like,
It's also a much shorter conversation.
And it seems like this relationship is much more meaningful to him than that one was.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's interesting that they call back to that.
Yeah, well, I actually didn't realize that that's specifically what he was speaking about. I thought he just meant, like, in general, I've had to talk to people who know they're going to die and who I know. But that makes more sense as a specific reference.
Right. Yeah, I've forgotten too. And that previous interchange did actually end with, there's something I have to tell you, which is kind of a... Yeah. Which is kind of a cliche, but it did lead to this one. And I do like how, in the end, Naomi tells him, shut up, we're not having this conversation because we're getting you out of there.
Yeah, I did say after that scene to Jen, I was like, she's the best girlfriend. She's like, I do have time to have this quick conversation and to be emotionally available to you, but also I need to go fix this problem that you found yourself in.
So the solution comes from the botanist, the steely-eyed man of science. And, of course, it comes to the very, very last minute because, of course, Prax is terrified and mesmerized by the hybrid, and it may actually be his daughter, who knows. So the very last minute, he tosses the nuke and hybrid goes after.
Yeah. That was stress-making, I have to say.
I definitely remember the first time I watched this episode kind of being like, yelling along with Naomi, like, what are you doing?
And Naomi is someone who's been very empathetic to Prax's, you know, internal conflict about this potentially being his daughter and her, you know, telling that story of having to let go of her son. But still, in that moment, when you're faced with the horror of the protomolecule man, yeah, she's just like, do the thing we talked about.
That's another, I'd completely forgotten she had a son, if it was ever mentioned before, which I'm not even sure it was.
Mm-hmm.
They don't bring it up a lot.
Yeah, although it always bothers me whenever her and Holden are talking about secrets, and she's like, this is the last secret I have to tell you. And it's like,
except for this one.
Except this other one that you still haven't mentioned.
Yeah. Someday you may have a stepkid.
Yeah, every time. What?
Oh, but there's so much trust among the Rossi crew towards the end of this episode. You know, once they get the hybrid off of the Rossi, you know, it's kumbaya, and Prax is part of the team too. You know, so much. I mean, this is the Rocinante family, and I'm just full of happiness and glee and, oh, crap.
Oh, I always want them to, like, stay in those moments. Like, I love those moments so much, but I think it is probably narratively more interesting for them not to.
Yeah, for me, the storyline felt like the most season premiere of the storylines, because even though it was direct fallout, it wasn't tonally, you know, it's the exact opposite of where they are in the finale. And I like that you have that visual of Holden getting rid of the Rocinante emblem on the outside of the ship. I feel like that maybe is a little heavy-handed as a, like, thematic call out, but also has a logistical plot reason. So it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, it hurts. From this point on in the first episode, Naomi's just on the outside. She tries to talk them into going to Tycho Station, and Alex and Amos are just not receptive at all until they get away from her and have time to evaluate it. And then when Holden counterproposes, no, you know, we haven't done what we need to do for Prax. We haven't done what we need to do for Prax's daughter. Naomi's the last holdout. She's the one just out there not being listened to. And this is really hard for me to watch.
Yeah, it is. Especially as, she's the only woman on the... You understand why it's happening, but you're so used to seeing, like, this woman of color get so much respect from her, like, male peers. This is the first time that it felt like Holden, or at least Naomi, wasn't kind of the captain in some to some percentage. Yeah, it's tough to watch, and I think it's well done because you totally understand why it's happening, even though you just want people to stop talking over Naomi.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to see a woman of color treated that way, and yet I see how it got there, and this feels to me like a situation where you can't put the character in bubble wrap. Naomi's actions make logical sense. They don't come out of nowhere. They're perfectly understandable, and the consequences are very realistic as well.
This is my favorite kind of angst.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with her decision, to be honest with you. Like,
yeah,
same.
The belt should have, if everybody else has got it, then why shouldn't the belt? I can see why Holden, they're all mad personally, but same time, like, and I, despite all logic, I kind of love Fred Johnson. I don't know why, but I do. So
no,
whenever he
gets
the upper hand.
I get you. I get you. We'll get to him in a bit, but yeah, I get you about Fred Johnson, and he certainly seems to be one of the more honorable characters on the show. The whole thing for the Rossi crew appears to be not the substance of Naomi's decision, although they are still really, really freaked out by the proto-molecule and think that it's dangerous and wish it didn't exist. It's that they made a decision, and she held back.
Yeah.
And I think that they made so many decisions after that where that knowledge, like, could have been useful. Mm. Like, I think especially Holden being on this, like, kind of very, like, blinded quest to eradicate the proto-molecule when she knew that there was more, like, so much more. The balance of power was very different than what everyone was making decisions.
Responding to.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it's, like, about that. Just, like, not trusting them to maybe come around to her point.
Mm-hmm. I had forgotten the detail of the context of her giving that information to Fred Johnson was that she thought she was dying, or very likely would die, when she was escaping Eros.
Same.
Which, she put herself in that position. Like, she had a lot of times when she wasn't facing imminent death. I mean, to be fair, a lot of the times they are facing imminent death. But she had space before that to tell the truth, to come clean. But the context of her doing it in that moment, I had forgotten about. And it's interesting they don't show that visually. But I guess they're, you know, holding out to have the big reveal at the end of the season to Holden.
It is kind of hilarious that Prax asks her, you just keep nuclear warheads lying around? The one that she had pulled out of the torpedo to put the protomolecule in, you know.
I'm still baffled by just how many nukes are floating around the solar system at this point.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts about the Rossi crew and their misadventures in these two episodes?
There's that moment with Alex where he sends a message to his family on Mars.
I call it the deadbeat dad message.
It's kind of a deadbeat dad message.
He call it the censored dad message, yeah.
Yeah. But I feel like it's supposed to resonate with me more than it does.
Hey, it just kind of comes off as a bad father, which is what he says he is, so I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least he...
I don't know.
At least he admits it, but, he comes out and says and admits that he was happier in space than he was at home. And I don't know how many points you get for honesty when you're an absent father. I mean, but at least there's a little emotional integrity in that moment. Mm-hmm. Cass Anver delivers it well, and I continue to feel really good about Alex, the character as played by him. But it felt like an acting moment for Cass Anver rather than an integral part of the story.
Does he apologize? I can't remember. Because I remember him being honest, but does anyone remember if he's like, I'm sorry?
I don't know.
If we don't remember, then it couldn't have been that good an apology.
No. Yeah, that's what I felt like. It felt unbalanced where I was like, wow, it's really cool you're being honest about you not actually wanting to be there and wanting to be here instead. Because I think more people should be honest not only with other people, but with themselves about things like that. But it didn't feel like saying that was enough.
No.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You better be paying alimony, bro. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. He tells them he loves them at the end, and that kind of, I'm sure it's heartfelt, and I'm sure it's honest, but it's also kind of hard to square with the actions that he describes.
I know. I just wanted to be like, what does love mean to you? Because also we see him being so adamant about keeping this family together on the Rossi. So it is interesting to see that that message in the context of him wanting so desperately to keep this other family together.
Yeah.
And it does. I like that aspect of it.
For sure. Well, I don't know that we can call Christian and Kajar and Bobby a family at this point, but God damn, that's a triad that I love watching, and they have so much to do in these two episodes. We mentioned briefly last time about how at one point or another, each of the three of them takes charge. Christian is really not good at space at all. My God.
I'll tell you what she is good at, swearing, and she does a lot of it in this one.
She's also good at shifting her understanding of reality. Like the moment when she thinks that Katier has like betrayed her or is strongly considering betraying her. And she's just like, okay, but once you betray me, make sure you do this. She's ready to like go there. She's like, okay, if this is what's happening, then can you at least promise me that you'll do this thing?
She's craftier than hell. She's the craftiest person like in the whole show as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and she processes these, like, very emotional moments. It seems like she does process them. She still feels them. She isn't a robot who is able to move on past things that hurt. She shows that she's hurt by Aaron Wright's betrayal. She would be hurt by Katier's betrayal. So it's cool that she has that balance of the emotionality while also the being able to make rational decisions, because I think a lot of times those are portrayed as opposites. And I don't think that they are.
Did we buy that Katier was going to betray her or consider it?
I didn't think so. No. Maybe a slight, tiny little touch, but no. I did like all the underlings arguing with each other, saying, hey, we're basically the guys that get screwed all the time. So
That was a good argument on that guy's part.
It was a totally good argument.
Yeah, and it really like bolsters Naomi's argument to Holden as well. Yeah. Which is a nice detail. It's like he's like one of Naomi's supporting facts in her thesis.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I really do like how Star Trek-y The Expanse's medical technology is, because all you have to do is slap an AED, a portable AED device on somebody, and it's not just good for a heart attack, it's good for gunshot wounds, radiation, poisoning, you know, all of that. It's very fortunate that Avasarala knows which buttons to push to save Kotcher's life, and he's up and walking after that gunshot.
Well, it has a nice, like, super clear user interface that's, like, step one, like, which makes sense when you're, like, you know, she's probably never saved him from a gunshot wound, right? I'm assuming there's a button that's, like, gunshot wound.
And she's on, like, this fancy yacht ship.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a warship.
But it's also just, like...
I just had this vision of trying to ask Siri to fix the gunshot wound. No! Not a, I don't know, guacamole bowl. Like.
Oh, God. We mentioned that Christian is really not good at space. Bobby Draper is really good at space. And this is when she really comes into her own as an action hero.
She gets so many cool hero moments in this, in these two episodes.
This might be my favorite ever sequence in The Expanse.
Yeah, she's so cool under pressure. You know, there's that line that Kotcher delivers where to Christian where he's like, this is why you hired me, right? Because I'm cool under pressure. And Bobby definitely has that too. It's like, 17 minutes? No problem. But she's urgent and focused, but she's not panicked. It's a really admirable quality.
You also get, like, you get sequences of, you know, the climbing in her power armor. Yeah, basically Iron Man on the outside of the ship. But you also get that, like, hand-to-hand combat where she's not wearing anything. It's just her physical strength. And, like, you can see that. I think Frankie Adams has some kind of background as a fighting martial arts. And that's a great... There's not a lot of that kind of fighting on The Expanse. And it's a decent scene.
She just looks like a bad mother in that outfit.
Yeah.
She's a boxer. So, I mean... Yeah, I would not want to cross her. As she said last time, burn me and mine and I'll go through you like a door. And not only does she physically overpower most of the crew, she also intimidates the hell out of that electrician dude.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's intimidation, but it's also some pretty impressive diplomacy. I mean, I don't think that's what she would consider it to be, but... She isn't just saying, like, you know, I will beat you up, although that is implied. But she's also like,
hey, it's requested.
Are you willing to die for this person that told you to do this thing? Which is a great question.
And then they make it to the Razorback. If you paid close attention to the details on the screen, because they didn't come out and say it, but there it is written on the side, and there is a screen with Julie Mao. This is the racing ship that Jules-Pierre Mao has been keeping, presumably for sentimental reasons. That was Julie Mao's pride and joy before she became radicalized for the OPA. So it's nice to see it in action. And that's a great set, and that looks like a scary ride to me.
Yeah, the fact that we see Bobby's reactions to taking the, like, medicine so they can go fast. The medicine so they can go fast. And also just when that kind of speed, how it affects her, I think that's actually even better than showing, you know, Christian react to how terrible or... intense this process is, because if Bobby's reacting like that, then she's a Martian Marine in her prime, how must this, like, person who is an older Earth woman be feeling?
I believe the proper term for that is zoom juice, by the way.
Thank you.
which I just invented right now.
It's good.
I mean, also Bobby, I don't know necessarily, she's never flown something like this. So there's that line where he's like, but can you, he turns to her and is like, you can, you're a pilot, right? And she's kind of like, I'll figure it out. Like, presumably she's piloted some, like, Martian shuttlecraft or something. But this is like,
and she's not just, like, casually, like, you know, floating out into space. She waits till the last possible moment. Like, the timing involved, it feels like that would, you know, she's so confident in doing this thing that she actually has never done before. But I love the quality of people in television and in real life who are honest with themselves and others about how much they know. And I trust Bobby so much. You know, like some people, if they were like, oh yeah, I'll figure it out, I'd be like, as characters or people, I'd be like, but do you mean that? What is the context around your thinking here? But with her, I'm like, she's not someone who, I don't think, at least in this situation, would boast about a skill that she doesn't think she could actually follow through and execute.
Any final thoughts about this terrible trio?
I love the scene of Christian and Cotillard leaving each other. Gets me every time. It makes me feel surprisingly emotional. And I'm also a sucker for any scene or shot of two people looking through airlock holes at one another.
Right.
Which happens to comedic effect in Doctor Who and dramatic effect in Doctor Who. But, you know, pops up every now and then in science fiction.
It's really hard to say goodbye to characters on this show, especially since this show has a decided body count and you never know when characters part if they're ever going to see each other again. Mm-hmm. Well, we know because we've seen it before.
Yeah, it's like slightly less dangerous than Walking Dead.
In the last couple of podcast episodes, we've been pretty harsh about the Arbogast. We've been bored by the Arbogast. We've been wondering why the Arbogast. And now I guess we sort of have the reason for why the Arbogast. And that's sort of the drama for the season finale is the fight with the protomolecule hybrid. But the image that sticks with you is that unearthly deconstruction of the Arbogast. So In the end, was it worth it?
I mean, I still don't care about these guys, to be honest with you. Like, their back and forth is kind of amusing, but they died when they needed to. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think visually this is such a beautiful and powerful moment. And I can imagine caring about these characters and how that would increase the impact in lots of different ways. Maybe in terms of the horror they might feel, in terms of the wonder they might feel, depending on which character it is, how it may or may not bond them together. But how I felt about this compared to the narrative time they gave it, you know, the fact that we saw these characters in multiple episodes, I think I would have felt the exact same way about it if they just showed up in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, they did have a character arc. I mean, Dr. Aterby and Colonel Janice, you know, they were like, we hate each other. Now we respect each other. Now we like each other. Now we dead.
That's TV, baby. That's TV.
And that's usually a character arc I can get on board with. But, you know, didn't really pull it off this time in The Expanse.
No.
The Arbogast didn't just blow up. There are protomolecule sparkles, and then it just looks weird, and you've got people floating in midair, and you wonder if they're actually going to survive. No, it's just extreme slow-mo. One of those figures floating in midair is a member of the bridge crew that we have never seen before all season that seems to get a disproportionate amount of screen time. Are any of the three of you familiar with or fans of MythBusters?
I know of it. I've never been a huge fan of the show, and I didn't recognize him here, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've seen episodes.
It's definitely one of those things that other people have been like, see this one episode of this thing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But also, the other guy annoyed me so much with his smug nerdery and hat that I just got put me off watching the show.
So I was a big fan of MythBusters, and I've watched most of the episodes. And Adam Savage is a noted nerd. He's doing stuff for tested.com, and he's doing like cosplay construction videos and things like that. He's kind of nerd royalty at this point. And he wasn't even in the background of any of the previous episodes. It's just like, this is a celebrity cameo. And I was wondering if this character who you'd never seen before, just sort of being semi-prominent at this time, was off-putting to you, or you just took it in stride because you didn't know or care who he was in the first place.
It wasn't off-putting to me, I think, because The Expanse is good at giving weight to background characters in a way that adds texture and depth to the world. So I just kind of assumed it was one of those moments.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did too.
I also realized I'm pretty sure I sat next to Adam Savage at the Star Trek Beyond movie premiere. Which at the time I was like, I was trying to figure out who it was because people kept coming up and being like, oh my God, hi. Da, da. And I'm like almost positive that's who it was. And we did talk a little bit. It was like the perfect scenario because I wasn't sure who he was, so I couldn't be intimidated by him. And we could just nerd out about Star Trek.
Sometimes I really envy your life, Katie.
Also, basically, I'm just realizing basically it was like an Arbogast situation.
We're just like suddenly sitting.
And there's this celebrity next to you. That was his cameo.
Adam Savage is there.
Hilarious. So The Expanse, once again mirroring real life. Okay.
Was it ever mirroring real life?
Well, I mean, you know, I've dealt with protomolecule quite a bit in my time, let me tell you.
Fair.
Last place we need to stop by is Tycho Station, and I'm just going to read literally from our show notes for this one. Jen writes, drummer does upside down sit-ups. I just want to talk about this.
That's reasonable.
I mean, it's, how does she do that?
While bleeding out, which is not the smartest thing to do in the world, but it is the toughest thing to do in the world.
I know, the part where she's talking to Fred Johnson and she's like, my doctor said I should rest. And then she like physically pounds her wound. And I'm like, okay, that's one choice.
Yeah, also, she's undeniably tough.
She's so tough. And like, I've seen multiple times where Kara Gee talks about this, like on Twitter, about like, isn't this cool, guys? Wasn't this a cool moment?
That's amazing. When I was watching it, I was impressed. And I was curious if it was one of those workout things. Like, obviously, it looks hard and most people couldn't do it. But I was wondering if it was something like the salmon ladder on Arrow, where Stephen Amell always talks about how, of all the like things he can do, that's actually not a very hard thing. It just looks really cool. And like maybe some of the things that are physically a lot more demanding and exclusive don't look as cool visually. So I'm curious. We should all go home and try our upside down sit-ups and see how hard it is.
What does this tell us about that character? I mean, besides just awe-inspiring.
She also just seems like someone who's like, I just have to keep going. Like,
she
no
is the belt
what.
Is basically what yes. she is. Like, she's the epitome of the belt. Just like rough around the edges and is probably going to kick your ass.
Yeah.
I think more than telling us something about this character, I think we already knew what we learned about this character in this scene. I think it tells us something about the show, which is, you know, the show is saying this is a scene that just has drummer in it. She's getting more of the narrative space. We're spending time with just her. It's saying this character is important to this story. And going into the conversation with Fred Johnson, it feels like her scene, even though Fred Johnson is another important character.
And that's a heck of a statement for the season premiere. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not, like, I don't want to say too much about this before we get into spoiler zone. But yeah, it feels like something that is indicative of how important she'll be as a character moving forward.
Well, I think, too, there's in that scene where she's talking to Johnson and she's like, we built Tycho together. It gives her a level of importance as a character.
Yeah. And it also says a lot about her sense of loyalty. She is really unhappy about Fred Johnson working with Anderson Dawes on this thing. Mm-hmm. And she really doesn't like this idea of going after the Nauvoo when Fred has pissed her off so much. And yet, can I finish my drink first?
Yes, that was very nice. So with just the right amount of petulance.
Yeah, and I love what she's saying about Dawes, which is something we've talked about. You know, she has that line about, I knew there wasn't a future if I stayed with him. Meaning, to me, like, he's not ever going to give up power in a way that you might, or, like, share power of responsibility, decision-making. And also, he is very willing to sacrifice the people under him for, you know, obviously the cause, but I mean, we mm-hmm. saw how he treated Julie Mal and thinking, you know, I don't know. I was thinking a lot about Julie's character in that moment. I was also thinking about Naomi's character in the scene and how when she does something like give the protomolecule sample to Fred Johnson, you know, she is friends with drummer, maybe more.
And definitely more. Yeah. I'm shipping it.
And so when she gives a protomolecule to someone like Johnson, you know, I'm assuming she's had conversations with Naomi about who this person is. She also knows giving it to Fred Johnson means that drummer's going to be there too, and what that means. So there's just so much to break down about their conversation, and there's so much you learn in that scene that I love and makes me think of so many other parts of the show and story.
Meanwhile, Fred. Okay, just a couple of episodes ago, he got completely played and betrayed by Anderson Dawes. And what does he do with Protomolecule? He offers a deal to Anderson Dawes. WTF.
He's intellectually got a point here. Like, it's it does make sense to unite the belt against everybody instead of having a bunch of infighting and having Protomolecule in the mix. That doesn't really work. So politically speaking, it's a good idea. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I wonder if his background as like an earther helps him in this context, and that he obviously has certain loyalties, but he isn't a part of one of these factions specifically in a way that someone who grew up as a belter, you know, not that you can't grow up in a faction as a belter and like still see the larger picture. That's definitely possible. And we've seen it from various characters, but maybe that's an easier jump or step for someone like Fred Johnson.
I'm still, I don't know. I get that Dawes has the scientist Cortazar. And if you have a protomolecule sample here and a protomolecule scientist here, that you put them together, you have something. If you keep them apart, you have less than something. But I share Drummer's skepticism of Fred Johnson's, you know, he just seems to be honorable, but painfully naive to me at this point.
Yeah.
A little bit.
We're now entering the spoiler zone for those who haven't watched past episode 1 of season 3 and you don't want to be spoiled for the rest of season 3. It's time to board the Razorback and race your way out of here. So we hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of the episodes IFF and Assured Destruction. That's episodes 2 and 3 of season 3. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, I guess, Stone Tablet somewhere, and follow us on Twitter at Legit Salvage. Everybody else who's already seen all of The Expanse, let's dive in further. So I have a feeling that the spoiler section is going to get shorter and shorter over the next few episodes because we're running out of Expanse.
Yeah. Running out of Expanse. That sounds so
until
sad.
We binge watch series 4 and then
And actually right before we started recording, I saw on Twitter that they just did a shot of them starting season 5.
Yeah. Oh, sweet.
Yeah, they actually raise a flag. They raise a Rossi flag on the set at the beginning of every season, and that's just cool. I want to visit that set.
I know.
I want to belong. I want to be part of the family. I want to.
Well, I'll be in Toronto in November. How do I do this?
There's a little bit of protomolecule left on the Rossi. Dum dum dum.
You missed a spot.
So I don't know if it was necessary. The theory about all of the hallucinations that Miller had of Julie and that Julie had of Miller and all that stuff is that the protomolecule stuff is not, strictly speaking, a linear time-bound kind of thing. So if you're caught up in this stuff, you're going to experience some out-of-time phenomena. So I don't know that we needed the protomolecule to be sitting there on the Rossi all along, but it is a help when Thomas Jane comes back as a weird-ass projection hologram thing and becomes a voice in Holden's head explaining the whole universe to him. I had much more of a sense of dread when I saw that bit of protomolecule and wondering what was going to happen from it, and then surprise.
The show is so bonkers. I never would have thought that was what was going to happen.
No, me neither.
Yeah, I think I imagined it just multiplying as a blue goo underneath their deck until all of a sudden they realized the Rossi was, like, infected.
Or it turns into a little protomolecule baby and they adopt it and raise it as their own. Oh, sweet.
And it's a wacky sitcom.
Guys, there's a lot of fanfic we could write about the direction this could have gone.
I'm writing the sitcom script right now.
And its name is Gordon Shumway, but they call him Alf for short.
Absolutely not. Let's not go get ahead of ourselves here.
So that, I don't know, did we need that to help set the stage?
I don't think we need it in the context of where, you know, Miller coming back as a tease for that. I think, especially watching it a second time, it just really hammers home. It's another support for Naomi's decision that there's just like, it feels like at this point there's just protomolecule like lying all over the place, which I know
it really
is.
It's not
totally the truth, but yeah, it's just another point in Naomi's favor in terms of the decision, which I do think like what we were saying before and the fact that she kept us a secret and, you know, just made a unilateral decision without trusting them at all is the issue. But yeah, this really does support her, to me at least, her decision to give it to Fred Johnson.
It kind of also, the thing I don't think I like about it is it's such a heavy-handed shot of them like closing up the deck and then like it's slowly the camera goes over to this blue goo. And it's like so many other clues like that are so quick that this is given so much narrative time.
Yeah, if they're going to do this, I want it to like crawl out of Holden's coffee maker or something. Or like from behind one of the like green spaces. And then it's just like, dun, dun, dun.
That would make the coffee maker smashing make sense.
You know, maybe the protomolecule could just sort of ooze over Holden and he's shocked and then he wakes up and he's wearing a black spider suit and he's dancing down the corridors of the Rossi like Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man 3. I don't know.
Yeah, okay, this is my last suggestion. Alex takes a fresh pan of lasagna out of the oven and it's kind of like shimmering blue a little bit.
Zoom in and freeze frame on his surprised face, and that's the end of the sitcom episode.
That's the final episode of season 5. I hate to break it to you, but there we are. Yeah.
They should definitely take these plot ideas.
Absolutely. Who needs to follow the books? But there's that, and then there's also the beginning of the Nauvoo as the recapture of the Nauvoo after it's just flying off into deep space and then turning it into the behemoth. That's kind of cool. And Drummer, her upside down sit-ups person, is going to be its captain. That's another reason I like how much attention they pay to her in this episode.
Everything you're saying makes sense, but I stand by my puzzling pro-Mormon stance.
I agree. Through every time, like watching this the first time, every time the Nauvoo or the Mormons were brought up, I was like, oh, finally we'll see the fallout from them stealing the ship from the Mormons. And like, that's going to come back. And again, so far it has not.
But yeah, like at some point these Mormons have got to come back with like battle armor or something.
Yeah.
They have enough money to build this generation ship. And presumably they sunk a lot of their money into this generation ship. But they must have more. Like, I doubt they put all their eggs into this basket.
No, I don't know why it bugs me so much, but it does.
Maybe it's very naive of me as well about, you know, how space might work, but I'm kind of surprised that no one's, like, snatched up the Nauvoo yet. If it is, like, such a sweet, sweet ship.
Yeah, she's floating
Earth
around.
And Mars
why wouldn't you?
Are distracted, but.
Yeah, they got stuff to do, but. Still, you're right. It is a sweet ship that just floating out there and is, I mean, if nothing else, why wouldn't you live on it? It's a colony ship. Why doesn't the belt just use it for extra space, you know?
Sometimes I lose track of how much time has passed in between episodes. So I don't even know how long the Nauvoo has been floating.
Yeah, it could be like a week or two. Who knows?
Yeah. It's only been 24 hours.
A last question that I have for you, and it is a question asked in ignorance. Because I don't read the books, but I'm wondering if 3 seasons in and getting ready to start on the 4th, I'm wondering if James and Naomi and Alex and Amos have plot armor. Are they going to be our characters, our viewpoint characters, our central characters, the Rocinante family going forward for the duration of the series, because they feel like the only ones at this point.
I really hope so.
Yeah. But in the books, doesn't it change? Like, it does goes with different characters in different eras. Like, I haven't read them, but that's what I gather from it. Like, what we saw at the end of series three here is like the next one would be in the books a whole new crew of people, and it would go further in the future, I think. Mm. Whereas this obviously doesn't. I'm fine with that, but because TV's different.
Having seen the first episode of season four, although I think you can glean this from the promotional materials as well, it does feel like they're heading into the most dangerous situation they've ever been in exploring this new planet.
Mm. Well, that's scary because it,
I know
it's not like they've been hanging around in like a country club up to now. So
yeah, it's all just been like relaxing and eating protomolecule lasagna up until this point.
Exactly.
Okay, do we ever see fallout from the coffee machine getting smashed?
Yes.
I don't remember off top. I think Amos comments on it, doesn't he?
Yeah, when Holden is like hallucinating and Amos kind of is like, it's okay, just don't break the coffee maker again.
Oh, yeah. I wish it almost like stayed broken, and every once in a while someone was like, wish we had some coffee right now.
Guess we're going to have to drink this herbal tea.
There's not enough passive aggression on the Rossi, although there's some in this episode.
Yeah, the moment when Prax is like, there's a lot of tension on this ship, and no one told me that going in. It's pretty... Yeah, dude.
I am curious how you guys are feeling. We've talked before about how we miss Prax. At this point, it feels like he could just be a permanent member of the crew, especially as they're heading into this mission that's specifically about him finding his daughter.
He totally feels like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I just hope I keep hoping he comes back for some reason.
But then we get an even weirder permanent addition of the crew later on in the season, which I'm sure doesn't last, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's the brief moment when Amos interacts with all the children who were saved when they saved May. And, yeah, that's a whole other sitcom we could have. Amos running the Rossi daycare with May.
And... I think we're committing some sort of crime by creating all these sitcoms.
Never.
Oh, my God. And this is why the people who are watching The Expanse in real time with us and skipping the spoiler section are just plain missing out.
Yeah, really.
So, listeners, thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss IFF and Assured Destruction. Until then,
you should try tea.